Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Would the owner of a chain of cinemas or an insurance boss make a good chief constable? Well, that's the latest wizard wheeze of the coalition government to improve policing. We find out what the local police federation think of the idea. And Friends of the Earth are here to share the latest with us on proposals to frack the Mendips and also our local Sino-Norman nuclear power station. And this programme's recommended Christmas book is, without doubt, The Operators by US investigative journalist Michael Hastings. It's about his surreal experiences embedded with the US high command in Afghanistan. He went afterwards to accuse the Pentagon of being identical to many of the US mainstream journalists and of declaring war on politicians and independent media. In June this year, Michael Hastings died in a suspicious fiery car crash in his hometown of Los Angeles. So are the lines between the military and what we see and hear in our national newspapers too close for comfort? Is the national press, as Hastings suggested, becoming just an arm of the military? Who do you ask if you want to fix an election or destroy an honest politician's reputation? Welcome to the secretive world of strategic communications. It's public relations on steroids. And we'll be hearing too from a former British Army psychological warfare officer. Well, we start this week by looking at the police, joining me is Kevin Phillips from Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening, Tony.
Let's start what I was talking about there. It's called direct, a wonderful term, direct entry. What does this mean?
This is effectively anybody that, to put it bluntly, could be the general manager of Tesco's coming in at superintendent, chief superintendent level within the police service. Having no experience of policing, having no experience of what goes on the ground, but having the, I suppose, academic qualifications to enter the police service as a leader, effectively.
Well, I mean, the argument for this, of course, is that many people are saying that actually the police is a little bit too insular and that you need some people who are go-getters from the wider community, the business world, possibly, to actually, in a way, change things for the better and to bring fresh ideas in, that it's a little bit too insular.
I don't fall out with the fresh ideas part of it. I mean, I'm aware that there's two thoughts of trains of thoughts on this. One, bringing chief officers from foreign countries, from abroad, into the organisation, or bringing the direct entry. Now, at this moment in time, they are looking at the direct entry at chief superintendent and superintendent level. Now, what you would be actually asking is a senior officer to be coming in at ground level, at a senior level, having to control and command a big area. As an example, Bristol City at the moment. We're currently advertising, even as Somerset Constabulary, for a district commander to take over Bristol. That's not going to be direct entry. That will be, at this moment in time, a substantive superintendent or chief superintendent. But you've got to ask yourself, and I think the people that work for Avon and Somerset will be asking, what's wrong with our qualifications? What's wrong with the people that actually know the city and actually know what goes on in the city?
Well, I mean, one of the people that's been talked about as someone who possibly could come and take over a force, even, I think it was the Metropolitan Police they were talking about, is this guy Bill Bratton. Now, he was a very successful, many people say, chief of police in Los Angeles, in California. Why not bring someone like that in if he's got the qualifications?
I'm not necessarily saying I wouldn't bring somebody in that's got the qualifications to do the job. Now, as you say, Bill Bratton's got some experience in policing, whether it be abroad or wherever. He knows what's going on within policing. If you bring somebody in that's got no knowledge whatsoever of policing, how can you expect them to command major incidents, etc., things like that? It's going to be a big problem.
So are you saying then that you think it's a different kettle of fish if it's people from industry, that would be actually more problematic? And if so, why?
I think exactly. You've got to separate what you're looking at. You mentioned Bill Bratton. If you look at Bill Bratton, he will have a lot of respect from many police officers around the world. If you speak about, and I use the term, and I don't mean it to be derogatory, but the general manager of Tesco's, what policing experience has he got? How will that person have the respect of the junior officers within the service?
Okay, how would that actually affect, do you think, junior officers in the service, if someone like that was brought in here in Avon and Somerset?
Well, I think you've only got to look at what happened a couple of years ago with the riots, you know, throughout the country in the metropolitan police area. Down Bristol, Stokes Croft, for example. If you're going to have somebody that's got no experience of policing trying to command an incident like that, how can that work? I cannot see how it would work.
But I mean, ultimately, this is the whole idea, is bringing new ideas, fresh ideas in. How close are we to this?
I think with regards to the direct entry, that is already, you know, we are already looking at that. That's been discussed in the media at the moment. It's been discussed throughout the country. The Home Office is already looking at potentially 20 direct entry superintendents or chief superintendents throughout the country to come in and have a look, you know, work within those organisations. I am aware that Avon and Somerset have said for the next 2 years that will not happen. And I think that's because we've got sufficient superintendents, chief superintendents at the moment. And clearly with the comprehensive spending reviews going on and all the cuts to the policing, they've got to cut down somewhere.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what's your thoughts about the idea? I mean, let's just leave Bill Bratton aside for a minute. The idea of bringing chiefs of industry in to run police forces.
Totally wrong. Totally agree with Kevin on that. Absolutely inappropriate. Silly idea. Why did they think of it? Bringing in Bill Bratton, not happy with that either. Los Angeles isn't Bristol. Policing is very specific to the communities it serves. And in actual fact, local people, local police officers who know their communities are irreplaceable by outsiders.
Why not the industry side then? I mean, you explain why not Bill Bratton.
Well, all right, well, let's have the head of Tesco's running the operation in Afghanistan for the army, eh? How does that sound?
No, we're talking about policing, Martin. We're not talking about the army.
No, but it's the same
army.
Sort of thing.
No, it isn't.
I'm afraid it is. In actual fact, running a business is not the same as running a police force. For example, police officers may often make decisions which are going to cost money, but they're the right moral decisions, and they're not there counting pennies, yeah? That's quite an important thing that police officers do not feel constrained when they're making decisions, that how much is this going to cost? It's what's the right thing to do. And police officers, and look at what they're trying to do with privatising probation officers. These people have been doing this job for years. They know it inside out. So let's sack them all and bring in some complete amateurs. What a stupid idea
Is. Do you have any view on the probation officer business, the attempt to privatise them, which has been talked about over the last couple of weeks, Kevin? Because I know, obviously, if probation isn't working well, then the police are immediately involved with these offenders as they have to get arrested and rearrested and then sent back to jail.
I think clearly, if the privatisation of the probation service comes in, I think the police service will have an increase in work, because whatever else, it's all for profit. Any private company that takes over any of these services, it's for profit. They don't come in it for nothing.
But it's going to be payment by results. So if they manage to keep people on the straight and narrow after they leave jail, then they'll be paid more.
I think it's quite interesting that you say payment by results, because clearly over the last two or three weeks we've had a number of issues with G4S and Serco, where they've been charging the government for various services that they haven't been delivering. And I think that's where you come back down to who's accountable for that.
But going back to this direct entry proposal, this government seems absolutely set on. It seems like it will be happening. What are the sorts of professional qualities that someone that's worked their way up through the ranks, or come in at a middle rank and work their way up that way to become a chief constable? What are the sorts of professional qualifications and benefits that someone that has spent their life in the police service will bring to that sort of position?
I think what you've got to look at is anybody that's come through the ranks, anybody that's come through and, you know, we've discussed many times before, Colin Port, he was a copper's copper. He understood what went on at the ground level. He understood what affected police officers. Because it's not just about the money side of it. It's not just about dealing with their business. This is about, as Martin says, this is about the communities, the people that you work with. And you only get that by working your way up through the ranks.
But hang on a minute, because Colin Port, for example, came from Norfolk and Northern Ireland. He didn't know Bristol very well at all.
But he knew the policing. He knew the communities and how to, you know, work with the policing communities. He knew all about policing.
One of the other big changes, of course, has been under this government is the Police and Crime Commissioners, Kevin. What are your thoughts about, we're a year into that now, how it's gone?
Well, at the moment, I think our current Police and Crime Commissioner, Sue Mount-Stevens, is effectively doing what she set out to do, which is be a visible face around the Avon and Somerset area. She started off with having a non-politics in her campaign when she was campaigning. Clearly, once you get elected, it then becomes a political animal and you have to dance to the tune of somebody.
Well, she's her own little political party in a way, isn't she?
Well, I know where you're coming from. You know, I mean, I think there has to be a working arrangement. There has to be a working agreement between the PCC and the Chief Constable. I suppose at this moment in time, one has to ask who's holding the Chief Constable to account, because clearly it's a very close working relationship. And, you know, I raise the questions, like with the privatisation of custody, which has been discussed at this moment in time.
So do you think this maybe it's possible for a too close a relationship to build up between a Police and Crime Commissioner and a Chief Constable, especially because Sue had this battle, really, didn't she, the end of last year with Colin Port?
I think you're absolutely right. I think you can get too close. I think, you know, there has to be an element of distancing yourself and, you know, being aware of what's going on, scrutinising the police service. You know, Sue Mount-Stevens should not have any involvement in the operational matters, but likewise the financing and everything else that goes with that should be down to Sue Mount-Stevens to deal with.
So is it thumbs up or thumbs down after the first year? What do you think, the old PCC business?
I think, if I'm totally honest with you, the jury's out with me. I'm still waiting to see where it goes, because clearly we had a new Chief Constable. We're watching where that goes. We'll see what happens in another couple of years' time, and I've got to be honest.
Okay, now you mentioned there the possible privatisation or a consultation that's going on with the custody units. Now, this is really the front end of policing, isn't it? When someone gets arrested and brought into the police station, as I remember happening to me myself, you get booked in at Trinity or somewhere like that by a police officer, I would have hoped. But no, it looks like that now may be a private company that does the management of that custody unit. First of all, what exactly is being proposed here?
Well, I think we're still getting mixed messages, if I'm brutally honest. Back in August this year, the Chief Constable Nick Gargan quoted custody suites, transportation and identification issues. They will be privatised, or there's a possibility that they will be privatised. Not that long ago, two candidates for the PCC put a challenge in with regards to the privatisation. They were told that it's all about beds, blankets and breakfast, which suggested they were talking about the detention officers. That's a mixed message, because from August to now it seems totally different. I'm aware of what the consultations are going on. The consultation finishes the middle of this month. I'm aware there's probably about five or six companies tendering for that business. I'd like to see what they're actually going to be doing at the end of the day.
So is that managing every single custody unit right across the Avon and Somerset area?
Well, eventually, come April the 1st next year, 2014, we should have three main custody suites, plus Yeovil as a satellite. So you're going to have Bridgewater, Filton and Keynsham as the main custody suites. The rest of them won't exist.
I mean, we're talking about, I mean, because there's been a lot of investment in some of these places. I mean, I think it's Staple Hill that's got a specially equipped custody suite for dealing with potential terrorist issues, this kind of thing. So does it mean that that's going to be closed down? I mean, I'm not really quite sure what's going on here, because I would have thought if money has been invested in relatively new facilities, that they should be part of the new regime.
Yeah, there will be one custody suite within the force area that will be retained for terrorist cases. The rest will all go to the three centralised custody units. As I say, Yeovil is slightly different because that's a bit of a satellite custody unit. But that will be run, it's a, what they call a PFI building. It's not our building, it's not Avenue Somerset's. We will effectively be renting that back from the companies that have built it. It's private investment. Now, if you go down the privatisation of Custis Suites or certain parts of Custis Suites, you can see where this is going. It's the thinner end of the wedge, and once we start losing police officers out of those Custis Suites, we start using the expertise.
Well, let's keep watch this space, see what happens with this particular consultation. So it's finishing middle of this month. Is there going to be an announcement? Do you know when that's going to be about you know, what's going to be happening with custody units?
Well, we should know sort of the beginning of 2014 as to if these contracts have been awarded. My personal opinion, I do think it's a done deal. I think, you know, the organisation have decided they're going to go down this route. Whether it's cheaper, again, I go back to my previous comment, these private companies are only in it for profit, and that's what my concerns are.
What about the whole sort of command structure, though? I mean, is it possible for the police, you know, sort of within the police hierarchy, to simply tell people in the custody unit to do things when they're actually working for a separate company?
Well, I think that's one of the big issues I've got, is the accountability. You know, the custody unit is a critical area of the business. If anything is going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong in the custody unit. Mm-hmm. And if we, and I'm going to say, God forbid, we have a death in custody and it's being run by a private company, or certain parts of that are being run by a private company, I've got to ask who's accountable. Because at the moment, they are looking at potentially a sergeant being in there, but a private company working within that. Does it all come back to the one sergeant that's working in there? That's my worries.
How have the government's cuts since 2010 affected the constabulary locally, Kevin?
I think we see, you know, we see what's happening. The cuts are being made. Invariably, we are losing police officer numbers. We've gone down from about 3,500 down to, I think we're down at about just under 2,900 police officers at this moment in time. Now, I know that when the new Chief Constable arrived, Nick Gargan, he said he didn't want it to go any lower. I would probably suggest with the new cuts coming in, the new budget cuts again, we are going to have to go lower. I'm aware that Sue Mount Stevens did ask the question as to whether there was going to be a precept rise of 2%, 10% or no rise at all, dependent on what people wanted within their policing. But even if the precept rise was 10%, all that is going to do is retain the numbers of police officers we've got now. It's not going to put more numbers of police officers on the streets.
OK. Also, one of the big stories that's been a national story is this whole business of Plebgate. Is it possible that this kind of thing can happen, where police officers, it seems, have actually been a little bit... haven't necessarily told the entire truth? I mean, we had the recording made by Andrew Mitchell himself, didn't we, where the police officers, actually it was, I think, from the Metropolitan Police Federation that came out and said he didn't tell us the full story, and then we hear, well, actually he did.
I think, if I'm totally honest with you on that one, Tony, there is still an investigation going on with regards to that. It would be wrong of me to comment on it. I do have my own personal views, which I'm not prepared to discuss at this moment in time. There's lots of factors going on with regards to Plebgate, and I think we've got to wait and see what comes out of it in the end.
Okay, Kevin, thanks very much. But before you go, let's just ask Martin that same question. What are your thoughts, Martin, about this whole business of Plebgate? Because we have a situation, don't we, where a government minister, in fact the Chief Whip, lost his job, what it does seem as if it may anyway be, due to faulty reporting, shall we say, from the Metropolitan Police Federation.
As I've said before, Tony, the scenario is revolving around whether you use the word pleb. He certainly used the F word to the police officers. He admitted that. Now, if I walk down the street and I use the F word to police officers, I can expect to get a problem, can't I? And if you're a Tory minister, it's exactly the same. You don't use the F word to police officers.
Ultimately, this is a difficult situation, isn't it? I mean, it starts to cast doubts upon the integrity of the police, doesn't it?
Well, frankly, the doubts on the integrity of the police go back a long way. I'm talking about deaths in custody. There have been hundreds of deaths in custody which haven't been properly investigated and all the rest of it. That's the serious front end of policing. This is a storm in a teacup.
OK, well, Kevin Phillips from Avon Somerset Police Federation, and Martin there making his comments too on Plebgate. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
And now I'm joined by Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike. Welcome to
Hello,
Drive
Jenny.
Time. Hot seat swapping there with Kevin Phillips. First of all, fracking in the Mendips. This is something we return to time and again. And so how exactly are we going? Is it going to happen? And when and if?
Well, we're still hearing rumours that planning applications might be coming through shortly, which could affect large areas of the Mendips, right up to the very boundaries of Bristol. We're at the moment, we've been working very closely over the summer with the affected communities in Lancashire and in Bolcombe in Sussex, where people have had the experience of these companies coming in seeking to, you know, drill underneath their villages, and not really knowing how to be able to check that the planning system is working correctly, that the Environment Agency and others are correctly licensing what the companies intend to do. When these companies plan to frack, they the process could involve forcing millions of gallons of water down under the ground, and then it comes up again. And
hang on, isn't there quite a lot of water under the Mendips anyway?
Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah, what it brings up is not only some of the water that's been forced down, but other water appears back up at the surface, has to be disposed of, which can be contain toxic materials and be naturally radioactive. So the companies also have to have a license to dispose of that wastewater as well. And through working with these companies through these communities quite closely, we realised that the licensing authorities were not really approaching that job with the rigour that they should have done, and we've had to come in and help the communities hold those authorities and hold the local planners to account.
So how have you done that?
Well, simply by using the expertise that we have in the planning system and the law. Now, many communities over the south of England and elsewhere, and back in up in Lancashire as well, may be facing similar threats in the future. So we're now doing some training events, and we're running one in Bath very shortly, a couple of weekends time, the 16th of November, where our planners and lawyers that have been working with this system over the summer and have got some, you know, probably as good an insight as anybody as to how it works and doesn't work, will be running sort of masterclass in how the planning system is supposed to work, how the licensing system is supposed to work. There are some places left on the training course, but we will be making full recordings of the day, both video and sound recording, so there'll be podcasts of the training day. So if anybody at a future date is facing these applications in their communities, we should be able to offer some of the help online from that our planning expertise has built up.
What's the upshot of the really famous one, which is Bolcombe, isn't it, in Sussex? What's the upshot of that now? I mean, I think they had, I'm right in saying, Quadrilla had a limited period in order to do some test drilling.
That's right. They had a limited period. They had said that they were going to apply to extend the period, but in the end they withdrew that application. So, you know, they haven't gone away permanently, but for the moment the drilling has ceased. And again, you know, we think that is probably due to the fact that we were pretty smart, and ourselves and the local community were able to really interrogate the detail of what they wanted to do, and
what's going on at Quadrilla? Do they feel that was a success and is likely to go on to greater things around different parts of the country or not?
We have no insight into the mindset of Quadrilla.
Spies in the Quadrilla boardroom?
We've actually had Quadrilla have been quite respectful almost in some of the things they said about the way that Friends of the Earth has conducted our campaigning over the summer. The chair of Quadrilla said that he found it hard to disagree with the things that Friends of the Earth was saying.
Good. And I wonder if anyone at GCHQ has got access to what's been going on at Quadrilla, and if so, would they please hand that information in a brown envelope over to Friends of the Earth so we can find out if Quadrilla have deciding to massively expand or maybe reduce what they're doing with fracking. I know there's a great little website called frackfreesomerset.org, Mike, which documents a lot of what's going on here in the southwest to keep track of basically keeping our Mendips free from these rather nasty chemicals being injected into the ground and finding their way into our water table and fire coming out of our taps and this kind of thing in the area. Whereabouts else can we keep track of what's going on in the Mendips and the potential of fracking there?
Yeah, there's a new Frack Free Bristol group has been set up. In fact, it was launched in Bristol probably about the last time I spoke to you, actually, so it was about 6 weeks ago. So there's a whole network of Frack Free groups, and they're fairly easy to find on the internet. Frack Free Bristol, Get the Frack Out of the Mendips, Frack Free Dorset. I don't know if there's a group in Gloucestershire, but there's certainly a need for a group up there as well, because the UK government is looking at issuing more licences next spring to allow the oil and gas exploration companies to move into whole new swathes of the country that have previously been frack-free.
Now, I know that the Nazis, when they were desperate for oil in 1944, they were doing a little bit of shale gas drilling, and I think it was in occupied France, possibly just in Germany, and that was only because they were so absolutely desperate for oil that they were doing it, because the Caucasus had been taken over by the Russians and their panzers were starting to grind to a halt. Ultimately, we do need to find alternative forms of energy. We're not quite, I hope, in the situation that Hitler's Nazi war machine was in 1944 as they were losing the war. But where are we going to find the energy,
When you talk about oil and gas, the situation is that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is the international body of climate scientists, recently published a report saying what was the carbon budget, basically, that the planet has. How much can we afford? More can we afford to burn before we go over these tipping points and really do huge irreversible damage to the global climate system? And it turns out that budget is about a quarter of the known oil and gas reserves. So there's a real issue here for the oil and gas exploration industries. They're sitting on these reserves, which they claim to be their assets, but actually they should be considered to be liabilities because they can't be burned.
Okay, we're also joined by Steve Dales from Hull, who's down. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, Steve, you've come to talk about what? This is something which is being introduced in Hull anyway. What is it all about, and how is it going to save us energy?
It's actually about an energy-saving device. It's a little thing called the Oxypod that a local charitable trust have
developed. Oxypod. Have you heard of these, Mike?
Not until I met Steve a few minutes ago.
Okay, right. Well, how does the Oxypod work?
Well, I went to their presentation, and it involves a process using implosion, basically. It explains it in the booklet. I'll just quote a bit out of it. It says, produces excellent fuel savings when connected to gas and oil-fired heating systems, or air-to-water and ground-source heat pumps. Oxypod will reduce actual boiler burn time and therefore will reduce the kilowatt hours of energy consumed.
Okay, how does it work though? Just explain it.
It forces the normally dissolved air that's actually in water, it forces it out, and that increases the thermal capacity of the water.
So this is the stuff that's going around your pipes, is it?
Yeah.
In your central heating system.
Yeah.
It makes it more efficient.
And it also reduces all the corrosive effects of having air in your pipes as well. So they've found that heating systems are lasting a lot longer. It's not got all the magnetites and things.
So what do you do? How does it work? Do you put it into your radiator? Or what
it's
do you
just
do? Is it like a sort of antifreeze you pour in?
No, it's actually like a piece of pipework that just connects in. It's an egg-shaped piece of pipework that this local heating expert developed. And he took it to his charitable trust. They didn't really believe it could be possible, but they've done exhaustive field tests. They've also had independent field tests done for the last 2 years and found that it did work. It's now being trialled apparently in about 20 London boroughs. And they've produced this snazzy little booklet with it, which I've brought to show.
Okay, yes, it's the Oxypod, Oxypod, and I think you probably going to need to get a plumber in to get it installed in your central heating system, but it certainly seems to work. Mike, also, we must talk about Hinkley, because I think since I've last seen you, the final decision has been made that we're going to have this Sino-Norman power station built down the road. Now, I mean, for me, the big problem with this is nothing to do with the health issues for the time being, but it's the fact that it's actually French and Chinese companies that are going to benefit in the long term and in the short term. We're going to get some employment, obviously, locally, but these are foreign businesses that are going to be making a fortune, and we are going to have to then pick up the problems. What are your thoughts about the whole arrangement, and why is it that Britain can't do this?
Yeah, it goes wider than just electricity generation as well, doesn't it? That we're finding similar things happening with our transport infrastructure. That it's actually the government has a sort of rigid belief that you don't want to have state-owned companies providing public services, and then we end up in a situation where we pay way over the odds for state-owned companies to provide our public services. They just happen to be owned by other states. They happen to be owned by the French or the German or the Chinese governments, and they are taking profits at the expense of our electricity bill payers and taxpayers.
Okay. What about the health concerns, though, and the safety concerns? We'll ask Martin in a minute about the money side of things, because I think, in a way, that is the thing that is the biggest problem. But what about the health concerns and about Hinkley? My problem with it is mostly to do with the waste. That waste comes long distance. It comes through Templemead Station once a week, I think, still, and then up to Sellafield to be reprocessed, turned into depleted uranium to be shot at hapless foreign countries. And explain, your concerns as Friends of the Earth about the health.
Yeah, well, at the moment, actually, the waste goes up to Sellafield and it sits in a tank because there's nothing. There is no process.
I thought they were supposed to reprocess it.
Well, yes, it's called a reprocessing plant, but the economics and the technology of reprocessing, for all the billions that have been thrown at it over the last 30 years, still has not been made to work. So it just sits in a tank waiting for something to be done with it. And this is one of the amazing
things. Cooling down, I suppose.
Well, it does, physically have to cool down before it can be handled. One of the things I find most alarming about the new proposed power station at Hinkley is that the newer technology that they'll be using in that power station will mean that fuel will not cool down enough to be able to be used for 100 years. So, in effect, we'll have a mini Sellafield created on the Somerset coast where all the burnt fuel from those power stations will have to be stored on site, so it won't be coming through Temple Meads on a train for another century. It'll be sitting down there. So the legacy of Sellafield and Britain's other kind of reprocessing plant, which they tried up right up on the far north of Scotland at Dounreay, is contaminated sea and contaminated areas in perpetuity, and the risk is we're just going to create another one at Somerset.
And the most annoying thing about all this is most of the if not all of the profits are going to China and to France.
Well, it's an extremely bad deal for our electricity bill payers because they're being asked to foot a bill now of twice the current going rate for electricity, but it's index linked. We don't know how much in reality they will pay, and then also the taxpayer has got the prospect that the taxpayer will have to underwrite any cost overruns on building the power station.
Well, that seems to me like the government ministers who signed that off. I mean, no wonder they got rid of Chris Huhne, because he might not have liked it. The government ministers signed that off are completely disregarding a fiduciary duty to the future, to our future generations, by saying, "Well, we're going to allow you to build this thing, but we will pick up all the costs." Martin, what are the economics of Hinkley?
Well, I mean, I think we've had a fairly good exposition of what they are. I think we're also not mentioning the waste. I mean, the waste hasn't been included in this at all. And that's another huge cost. I mean, when they tried to privatise the nuclear industry in the 1980s, I had to write a paper on it for NEF. And I did the research. And, of course, at first, the city was slavering at the mouth. Great, we're going to buy up this industry. And as soon as they actually looked at the books and said, so we've got to actually insure against this kind of threat. And once the insurers had a look at it, they just said, no, you're joking. Which is why we've got two state-owned companies backed by the British state building Hinkley. Because if it was the private sector, it would have been just shoot it down and say, this is rubbish.
Mike, something has to be done, though. Again, I'm going to ask you the same questions I did with fracking. We need to get our energy from somewhere.
Yeah, in a couple of weeks' time, the 10th of December, there's going to be a public examination opening, a big planning inquiry into a proposal for a very large offshore wind farm in the Bristol Channel. So the alternatives are feasible and are being developed. I mean, it's a controversial scheme. Friends of the Earth is keen to see go ahead. On the evidence that we've seen so far, we think it's the right way to be going. Our offshore wind farms, now, where the UK is the world leader in offshore wind farms.
Well, we've got quite a lot. Sure, haven't we?
We have, and we've got quite a lot of wind. And last year, our offshore wind farms were generating making electricity more efficiently than gas-fired power stations were. They were delivering.
How do you measure that, though?
They were delivering, if you work out what the maximum possible amount you could have got out of those wind turbines, if they were going full tilt all the time, they were delivering a third of that. The gas-fired power stations were delivering 30%, so slightly less. So wind turbines were actually more efficient than gas.
What about tidal energy? Because we've got one of the biggest, if not the biggest, I think one of the biggest tidal reaches in the world, haven't we? The amount of quantity, I wouldn't even like to think about the cubic yards or metres or whatever, or miles of water that flows in and out of the Avon Gorge every day, twice a day, in fact. Why aren't we using that?
There is a huge potential here. We've got a lot of the companies that are developing tidal technologies based here around Bristol and around the Bristol Channel. We're very keen to see proposals move ahead for less damaging ways of exploiting the tidal rise and fall in the Severn than you would have had with that big barrage, which has just been kicked into touch again. So it's a situation where Bristol really stands to win. And you can have.
We've been talking about it for years, Mike, for decades.
We have been talking about it for years and decades, but actually, technology has been moving on. And we have now got some better ideas of how to harness that potential tidal energy than the very environmentally damaging Severn barrage that the discussions were always about in the past. But I'd just like to go back to what your other guest was saying just a moment ago about a little gizmo you can put on a boiler. Let's not just get fixated on generating energy. Let's just look at some really, really cost-effective things that we can do that can reduce the amount we need to use in the first place.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about the use of tidal energy and wind energy? I mean, what's your thoughts about that whole spread of what we should be using? Because this seems to be something that we again and again we're coming back to, and nobody seems to have a clear answer.
Well, to be honest, I was just going to make the point that has just been made: the solutions lie in simple, small technologies saving energy. In 50 years' time, if we get it right, people will look back and say, goodness me, did they waste energy the way they do now? Because in actual fact, we can have a perfectly good standard of living using a fraction of the energy that we currently use.
Well, what are we
and
using?
That, in fact, is the solution. We don't need to build anything, probably.
What are we using our energy for, Mike, that we shouldn't be?
Well, we've got hugely leaky houses, so our standards of insulation and draft proofing are the worst in Europe, and we're continuing to build to a very low standard. So people are using much, much more energy than they should be having to, just to keep the house warm, because most of it is being wasted. But I mean, that's part of the problem. But we have all sorts of other ways in which we're inefficient in the use of energy as well. It's taken years to get for the energy efficient light bulbs to really penetrate the market as they should have done. We've got far more efficient versions of moving around than the internal combustion engine and a system based on everybody having their own car that we could be prioritising.
Railways, possibly?
Railways might just possibly come into that, yes.
Okay, give us an idea of how people can stay in touch with Southwest Friends of the Earth, and you mentioned a couple of activities. Maybe you could just remind us of where and when they're taking place.
Well, the activities were the training day on how the planning system relates to fracking. It's quite a technical day. I wouldn't recommend it for sort of absolute beginners, but we will be placing details online. That's happening in Bath on the 16th of November. The public inquiry into the big offshore wind farm is starting in Bristol on the 10th of December. You can keep in touch with us. You can call me. My phone number's 0117 942 0128. We've got a website, bristolfo.org, and we've got a Facebook page, Southwest Friends of the Earth, and you can get details of all these things on Southwest Friends of the Earth Facebook page.
Okay, well, Steve Dales and Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us this evening on Drive
Time.
Welcome.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, last time we covered the heads of the security services on this programme, all we were allowed to say was a recording of Andrew Parker, the head of MI5, saying, "My name is Andrew Parker, I'm the head of MI5. This time, we got an hour and a half of it this week, Martin. I wonder what your thoughts are about the idea of bringing this out a little bit more into the open, because it just seems as if there is a bit of pressure on Sir Malcolm Rifkind and the Intelligence and Security Committee to be a little bit more open. open about the way they do things. They're telling us time and time again, basically, you've just got to trust us on this.
Well, yes, that's exactly what they say. And in fact, I'm not very happy with any of the things that they've said. I mean, they shouldn't be making comments about The Guardian, whatever their opinions about it. I think the idea that The Guardian's revelations about the NSA are causing problems with terrorism and so on, they would say that, wouldn't they, in the immortal words of Mandy Rice Davis. And I come back to what I said earlier. In actual fact, in the fight against terrorism, as in Northern Ireland, there should be police primacy. And you know why? Because the intelligence services are often suspects in terrorism cases. And people may be shocked by that, but of course people in Belfast or in Bologna, they're not shocked by that. That's the real world.
Well, we heard earlier on the committee talking about how much the security services have grown since the end of the Cold War. Let's now go back to that discussion which took place yesterday afternoon, was chaired by Sir Malcolm Rifkin, the Intelligence and Security Committee, with Sir John Sawyers, the Chief of MI6, Andrew Parker, Director General of MI5, and Sir Ian Lobban, the Director of GCHQ. And this time, this is a question which is posed to Andrew Parker from MI5 by Sir Malcolm Rifkin about the accusations that the Edward Snowden revelations have been very damaging to British national security.
Mr. Parker, in your recent speech to Rusi, you said, I want to quote your words, you said, it causes enormous damage to make public the reach and limitations of GCHQ's techniques, and that such information hands the advantage to the terrorists. You then called that the gift, your words, the gift they need to evade us and strike at will. Mm. Now, although obviously we appreciate you may be limited in some of the detail you may be able to go into today, I think the public are entitled to know more about this enormous damage that you say has been caused by the publication of classified material. Can either you or Sir Ian Lobban give examples, specific examples, as to how this has, in your words, been a gift to the terrorists?
You're right, Chairman, that giving examples in specific cases, as you said in your introduction to this session, is going to be difficult in public session. We could do that in private session later if you'd like. But there are two things tucked up in the comment I made in my speech. One is the dependence that we now have on the fantastic work that GCHQ do to detect terrorist communications. And that leads to us finding terrorist plots that we would not otherwise find, that we're then able to thwart, which leads to lives being saved. And there are real instances of that, including this year. Now, the advantage that we have as intelligence agencies that leads to that sort of opportunity, as I said earlier, can be fragile. And if we lose it, then we're just making a very difficult task even harder. And that's what I meant in the speech.
I would like to come in, if I may. So, SIGINT successes over decades, going back to the Second World War and beyond, they depend upon our intelligence targets being at best unaware or at best uncertain of our successes. So if you think what happens if SIGINT, signals intelligence, sources and methods are revealed, it can be a sudden darkening. More often it's gradual, but it is inexorable. So what we have seen over the last 5 months is near daily discussion amongst some of our targets, and I will bring out some, I will give you an example. We've seen terrorist groups in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere in South Asia discussing the revelations in specific terms, in terms of the communications packages that they use, the communications packages that they wish to move to.
So would you mean this is online, or are you saying you have other ways of knowing?
We have intelligence on. We have actually seen chat around specific terrorist groups, including closer to home, discussing how to avoid what they now perceive to be vulnerable communications methods, or how to select communications which they now perceive not to be exploitable. I am not going to compound the damage by being specific in public. I'm very happy to be very specific in private.
There's been a sudden darkening. That was quite an interesting expression that you used there. Martin, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, you can take it at face value, or you can say, do I trust what this chap's saying? It was quite clear from the very early stages of the war in Iraq that the Iraqi resistance worked out quite straightforwardly that we just won't use electronic communications at all. No mobile phones, No, we just don't use electro. I mean, anybody who is running a terrorist operation or a resistance movement, if we want to call it that, whatever it is, must be aware of the capabilities of Western eavesdropping. So the obvious thing to do, if you're involved in that, is A, don't use any communications at all, and B, when you have to use communications, just send them confusing messages like shouting up a stethoscope. Now, the real problem, is, I'm coming back to this now, and people have really got to understand this, and I'm going to bang it home for the third time in this show. The security services are suspected by top police officers in countries like Italy and Turkey and other places of being the fount of terrorism. They're talking about Al-Qaeda there. Al-Qaeda was set up by MI6. The question Sir Malcolm Rifkind should have been saying to the head of MI6, so any regrets about founding Al-Qaeda? Any regrets about it? I mean, you obviously did a good job of driving the Soviets out of Afghanistan. A lot of heroin came out on the streets in Britain. But, you know, you got the Russians out of Afghanistan. Any regrets about setting up Al-Qaeda as part of that process? And he would say, but of course. What the argument is that they set Al-Qaeda up. They agree that. It's all in the film, the Tom Hanks film.
Charlie Wilson's War.
It's all in there. MI6 was the lead agency on it. They set it up. And then what they're claiming is they set all these terrorist groups up, but they don't have any contact or influence over them now. And of course, what's absolutely clear in Syria is that MI6 and British Special Forces are training those Al-Qaeda-linked groups which are fighting Assad, just as they did in Afghanistan in the 80s. And I just, I mean, the French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, the other day, a few weeks ago, was on television in France saying he was approached by British officials at a meeting before the Arab Spring, I presume those officials would be MI6, saying, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria, would you like to join in? So I'd actually say to the head of MI6, if I was sitting on that committee, right, the French Foreign Minister says that you started the war in Syria. Any comment?
And if you go, well, I couldn't possibly comment. It's interesting, isn't it? Because those questions haven't been asked.
No, they haven't been asked.
Also, it's very interesting, on Channel 4 News last night, former intelligence officer Annie Machon was saying that the figures that are given for the number of plots been in the past proved completely fictional. In the United States, something like 30 plots we've managed to stop. Actually, it was only one. So we are taking a tremendous amount on trust here. Ultimately, do you think that there's anything gained by the exercise yesterday?
Not really, no. I'm rather disappointed in every... I mean, I would expect them to say not very much, or if they're going to say something, I expect it to make sense. So when the head of MI5 in the run-up to the Olympic Games said two things, first, the G4S are doing a splendid job, and then the second, he said that the only real threat is we've got from the Iranians. I just don't believe there was an Iranian threat to the Olympic Games, and I don't expect the head of MI5 to be coming out with that rubbish. Clearly, they are lying to us. They are lying to us because, in actual fact, a lot of the terrorism... You spoke about these plots in the US. All these plots have been arrested. They've not found a single one, as far as I know, which wasn't created by the FBI. So they go out, create plots, and then say, look, we found a plot. And, of course, that's a big money spinner for them, isn't it? Keeps everybody in overtime.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
So are the lines between the military and what we see and hear in our national newspapers too close for comfort? The National Press's Michael Hastings, a US investigative journalist who died in June, suggested becoming just an arm of the military. Who do you ask if you want to fix an election or destroy an honest politician's reputation? Welcome to the secretive world of strategic communications. And we're going to hear now a little extract from the film The Big Boys Gone Bananas, a documentary, and is someone who's an expert in strategic communications. This is Public Relations Times 10, Tim Burt.
The reality is that the media is much more willing to take down stories when a company comes to them and say, listen, don't write that story now because you're going to look stupid. And we will go out with a massive denial and we'll go after your media organization as well. I know of global corporations in the US who have threatened to pull advertising from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, because they don't like the editorial coverage. So there isn't as much investment in investigative journalism as there was in the past. Journalism itself is under threat. We now occupy an era of extreme reputation anxiety among leading companies around the world, because they're very aware their corporate reputation, which they may have built over 50 years or so, can be shredded in a matter of minutes So when a company feels that it's under potential attack, you either try and divert attention from the real story, or you have a snow dump of good alternative information. So they will go out there and say, listen, we've got this story about our reputation being under fire by this disreputable Swedish filmmaker acting for a lawyer who we think is fraudulent. You can have this exclusively. We'll give you all the background information. And you plant the story.
Amazing, isn't it? Really, to think that stories can be planted like that by big corporations. This, of course, links up slightly, Martin, with what we were saying earlier on about GCHQ. I mean, if they're under pressure to sell information, a big corporation might actually buy that information. The reason they might know that a story is about to hit a national newspaper is because the GCHQ people tell them.
Yes, and isn't it interesting that Jonathan Evans, the former head of MI5, has got a new job running security for HSBC, who were just convicted of money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels. Isn't that interesting? And no doubt he's filling his boots doing that.
I don't think we heard any questions about that from Sir Malcolm Rifkin.
No, well, Sir Malcolm's a bit of an insider, isn't he? That's why he's allowed to head the committee. One of us. Safe pair of hands.
What was being said there by Tim Burt is that there's a tremendous amount of manipulation goes on behind the scenes, sometimes even before a story hits the headlines. Denials are put out there. In fact, counter stories hit the headlines before the initial story is even get a chance to put its boots on.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, people think that what intelligence services do is spend a lot of time finding out things. What they actually do is spend a lot of time peddling disinformation. Probably 90% of their activity is disinformation. Only 10% is actually information gathering.
Well, this film is called Big Boys Gone Bananas. It's all about the big banana company Dole, and it's about how some Swedish filmmakers tried to make a film which was critical of some of their practices, particularly in the countries where the bananas are grown, and they found they were up against a massive campaign of disinformation about their film, basically denials, legal threats and this kind of thing. So let's hear now from former psychological warfare officer in the British Army, now working in the strategic communications industry, Sven Hughes.
So if it's Frederick's a bad guy, if I can get that narrative into the newspapers first and make it sticky and appeal to people in a way that they'll want to tell their friends, then that's the story that will go out.
Aggressive comments appeared in the commentary track after online articles. Can you also buy false grassroots on the internet?
There is no question at all that people at the moment in strategic communications are using false identities in the virtual space to raise awareness of certain issues. You put 30 people in a room who are paid to pretend to be brand advocates. Now, that's essentially what people are talking about with this kind of false grassroots campaigning, which is astroturfing, and that's illegal. Strategic communications have a stream of people they're hiring who aren't from traditional PR backgrounds, and that includes former members of the security services, former members of psychological operations, former members of essential behavioural change industries that clearly, up until recently, were fairly covert. As a consequence, now the lines of service offering are getting a bit blurred because these people are coming in with non-traditional approaches. So, for example, you might look at someone you're trying to supposedly take down, smear, whatever it may be, by looking at the way in which you could put fissures between themselves and their support structure. One of the ways they may have assessed your battle worthiness, your ability to sustain the fight, would be to look at your finances. Another one would be to look at where you are with your life at the moment. I mean, are you an alcoholic? Are you suffering from stress? Are you, you know, you've got to look at the individual that's coming against you. Are there masses of skeletons in the closet? Have you done this before? Would that involve perhaps the services of a private investigator or something? Phone hacking, email reading, it happens. People buy and sell those kind of services all over the world. And when you've got hundreds of million dollar industry that needs to protect its reputation, a few million being spent on a campaign to do just that is probably money well spent. I think you're being a little bit naive if you think that you can take a pop at a big multinational and expect to walk away without some sort of fight on your hands. They spend millions on their brand every year, and you're going to come in and start sullying their brand and start attacking their brand. What did you think was going to happen?
Interesting. That's Sven Hughes there, former British Army psychological warfare officer. Martin, this whole battle to preserve brands is actually at the expense of personal liberty, and in fact, in many cases, in this case, in this film, Big Boys Gone Bananas, it's in expense of the truth.
Well, of course, and I think it's quite, isn't it interesting that but you remember the McDonald's too, the McLibel trial, where Dave Morris and Helen Steele defended themselves for writing a leaflet so-called defaming McDonald's. All it was, it was an A4 leaflet. But you know what? We've now discovered that the leaflet was written by an undercover police officer. So McDonald's spent millions on the trial, gave them really rubbish publicity, in actual fact. All of their bad behaviour was dragged in open court. It's a really stupid idea of McDonald's to sue these people. And it turns out that the actual leaflet itself was written by an undercover police officer from the Special Demonstration Squad. Maybe McDonald's should sue the Met.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Time to sign off now. Up next is Cyrus the Virus and the typical topical Afro tropical show, we hope. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Councillor for Clifton East and Deputy Leader of the Lib Dem Group on Bristol City Council, that's Christian Martin, and of course to our old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, to Steve Dales, Mike Birkin and to Kevin Phillips. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. Please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. A Royal Marine's facing a mandatory life sentence after being found guilty of murdering an Afghan fighter.